This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is one of my favorite writers, Scott Spencer. His novels include Endless Love, which is so much better and so different from the movie adaptation, and A Ship Made of Paper, which was nominated for a National Book Award. Spencer's new novel, Willing, shows off his dark sense of humor. It's about a down-on-his-luck freelance journalist, Avery Jankowski, who gets an offer he thinks will turn around his life. Avery's uncle Ezra once loaned money to a guy who now runs an international sex tour. Men pay $135,000 to meet what they are told will be very classy, beautiful prostitutes. Uncle Ezra can get Avery a freebie. Avery parlays the offer into a big advance from a book publisher. The idea is he'll go on the tour, without mentioning he's a journalist, and then write all about it for the book. The novel follows Avery as he is suddenly in a world that is much more unsavory than advertised. By the way, parents, we'll be talking about an adult subject, but the interview will not be sexually graphic. The novel itself isn't so much about sex as it is a character study and social satire. Scott Spencer, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'd like you to do a reading. You know what the reading is, and I'll ask you to introduce it for us.
Well, we're going to listen to Lincoln Castle, who's the entrepreneur and tour leader of this around-the-world sex trip that these men are on. And I think you'll hear in his voice all the self-justification and lack of personal insight that is his hallmark. And this is what he says. Now I want to say a couple of things about the girls we'll be meeting. We're very proud of the talent we've gathered for you fellas. Make no mistake, you'll remember this trip for the rest of your lives. Notice our itinerary. No typical stops made by a bunch of guys looking for female companionship. If what you want is to go to a bar or a massage parlor in Thailand, then you don't need Fleming tours. These are the kind of girls, women, you see at the movies or sometimes even in the movies, and you ask yourself, how come there's no one like that in my life? Why do I work day in and day out and never enjoy this kind of beauty? These are the kind of girls you see when you're driving past an American college campus and you see one walking with her friends with a sweet little oval face and dark brown hair down to her shoulders, wearing a sweater and jeans and carrying a book bag, and the next thing you know, you've almost crashed your car into a tree because you've been staring at her. These are the girls you see on expensive beaches or coming out of expensive stores. Are you getting the idea these ladies are expensive? Well, they are. They're not whores. Let's get that settled once and for all. They all have lives that are far outside what we'll be sharing with them. They're students, teachers, nurses, dancers. All they have in common is their uncommon beauty and their willingness to tiptoe out of the straight and narrow now and again and earn themselves a hefty fee. And they have one little weakness in common. It's this. They love American men. These are girls you actually yearn for, not just because they've got dynamite bodies, but because they're simply beautiful in and out. These are God's Grand Slam home runs. Think unattainable girl next door. Think of your best friend's daughter or your daughter's best friend. Grown up, of course. We're not doing anything that UNICEF or anyone else is going to be coming at us for. We're grown-up men meeting some very special grown-up women. And now I can tell you something I couldn't, according to legal, tell you when we were on terra firma. There is very, very little that is out of bounds with these very special ladies. They're all committed to the proposition that you men are going to roar like lions, and if there's something a little special you want, guess what? They want it too.
That's Scott Spencer reading from his new novel, Willing. Yes, you mentioned the self-delusion that or lack of self-insight that this character has. How true. At the risk of sounding naive, are there tours like these?
Yes, there are. There are tours like these. Of course, it's common that there are tours like these to South Asian countries. There are tours like these to Latin American countries. There's tours like these to Caribbean countries. There's not, as far as I know, a tour like this that only goes to Nordic countries. However, there are tours that go to specific Nordic countries. There's tours that go to Russia. There's tours that go to Latvia. There's tours that go to Poland and Hungary.
And what do they charge? Yes.
They charge, well, in my book, the price is really, really high. They're charging $135,000. Of course, my character, when he hears this, wants to know immediately, are meals included? The answer is yes.
No, you know, in the book, the main character is a novelist who goes on this tour so he could get a big advance to write a book about it. Of course, I have to ask the obvious question, if you went on a tour like this to research your book.
Well, I certainly researched this book, but I didn't research it by going on a sex tour. But I could never conceive of writing about these countries without visiting them myself. And I visited them myself pretending that I was one of these men. However, on one of the trips, I was with the woman I was living with, I am living with, and on another one, I was with my son, so I was pretty well chaperoned.
Well, we've heard the kind of sales pitch for the sex tour. I want you to do another brief reading, and this is from the point of view of the journalist who knows not to believe everything that he's just heard.
I tried to imagine what the women who were waiting for us were thinking. Were they sitting with their arms folded, rocking back and forth, their faces blank, their private parts anesthetized with dread? Were they smoking crack or bent over ceramic dishes snorting up long lines of coke? Were they napping, applying makeup, perfuming and anointing themselves? The enormity of the wrong we were about to do presented itself to me, and then it was gone, and then it reappeared a moment later, and it seemed smaller, just a matter of how things were and always had been.
You know, Avery, the journalist who takes a sex tour so that he can write about it and get a lot of money to write about it, knows the enormity of the wrong about the things they're about to do, but he ends up participating anyways. And he comes up with his own rationalizations. What are some of the rationalizations you've given Avery to defend his participation in the tour, even though he initially intends to just stand back and write about it?
Well, Avery, of course, is embedded. And when you're embedded, you are in a moral quandary all the time because it's very hard to stand up and remain separate when everything around you is going in a certain direction. I think in the end, Avery believes that he just can't out-debate his body. The temptation of that beauty and his own loneliness and just the realities of being a man in his late 30s and the flesh being the flesh, he simply can't stand up to it. I always knew that Avery was going to succumb to the temptations of being on the sex tour. I didn't know he would succumb so quickly. I think he really succumbs basically his second night there.
And he also says to himself things like, well, I've paid for a lot of services. I never thought of paying for sex before,
exactly.
But you pay for everything else. You pay to get the earwax removed. You know, you pay for everything, so why not pay for sex, too?
He talks about the earwax. He talks about paying an elderly man to carry his suitcases up to his hotel room. He talks about just having somebody clean his teeth, about cutting his nails and cleaning his apartment. And he says, why are we thinking that these things are somehow less degrading than having sex with somebody for money?
And here's my favorite of all the rationalizations that all the men on this tour give for paying for prostitutes. And this is a guy who says, people talk about how dangerous it is for girls. I mean, dangerous compared to what? To being a cop or a fireman? To working in a coal mine or a steel mill? More dangerous than building a bridge or washing windows in a high rise? More dangerous than working in a nuclear power plant or driving a truck? People are killed on movie sets, too. You ever hear of Vic Morrow? I just love that. You know, like everybody's got their reasons why it's okay for the women and it's okay for the men to buy them.
Well, it's the hypnotic power of language, and it's about spin in a way. You know, I began this book when the war in Iraq began.
What's the connection?
And somehow that war, even though it's just mentioned here and there in my novel, put such a pressure on me when I was writing this book, because I would listen to all the spin and all the justifications on one side or the other, and I realized that it's just so impossible to base what you feel and believe on words, that the moral certitude has to come from within and in some place that's almost impermeable by words.
But that's the thing with this character, is that he's lost his moral compass once he's taken out of his environment and put in the sex store. I mean, in fact, he started to lose it even before the sex store, which is part of the reason why he allows himself to go on it in the first place. But there's a lot of questioning beneath the surface of this book about what is it that guides you? What kind of moral compass do you require? Is it religion? Is religion corrupted? Is it some kind of, you know, inner thing? Is it your parents, what they've taught you? Is it, like, what is it? And particularly, like, when you're out of your element, when you're, like, physically unmoored from your own background and your own environment, what is going to serve as your compass?
Well, that's very much the question that I was asking myself when I was writing this book. And, you know, of course, I don't have an answer to that. But it's a question that you grapple with. I mean, how do you behave when nobody's looking? If you don't believe that God is looking down at you, how do you do the right thing if no one's ever going to know about it? You know, there's a couple of secrets in this book. You know, there's an unacknowledged character in this novel, and it's the internet, which, you know, the World Wide Web, which I think is so well named because it not only catches, you know, billions of bits of information flying around, but it has the potential to catch people too. And in a way, this novel is a version of what it was like for Avery, and frankly for me, to step into that torrent of erotic information available on the internet, you know, information like photos, film clips, blogs, phone numbers, addresses, dreams, you know, come-ons, products, cures. And it just goes spinning and spinning, you're tumbling through it.
Well, you know, let me just read something about online porn that you say in your novel, Willing. And he's been, your main character, Avery, has been looking a lot at internet pornography. And he says, what happens to our wiring when we see not one or two attractive women, but dozens of them? In click world, there are hundreds of thousands of naked women, and they are pointing at their sex organ and saying, come on. And then that's just how things are done in click world. And then he says, in the gloomy, hypnotic safety of the internet, with its ceaseless presentation of a world that was full of spectacle and danger, I was completely safe because it was fundamentally not real. And your point is, in part, since it's not real reality, it's just virtual reality, you can do anything. And again, that kind of moral compass stops working.
I think so. I think that it's almost, you know, what Don DeLillo called information sickness. We were probably wired to respond to attractiveness and beauty and something that appeals to us when the human animal would only see maybe 500 people in his entire lifetime. When you're seeing 500 people per minute, there's a kind of sickness comes over you. And you lose your way. And this, you know, this book is so much about losing your way and trying to find your way back.
My guest is Scott Spencer, and we're talking about his new novel, Willing. And it's a novel about a journalist named Avery who needs money, and his girlfriend's just left him. So he decides what he's going to do is take his uncle up on an offer to pay for him to go on this sex tour to Nordic countries. And he parlays this into a really big book advance. So the idea is he's going to make a lot of money by going on the sex tour as a journalist. He doesn't plan to participate in the sex, just to observe what happens on the tour. But of course, he loses his moral compass and participates quite a lot. To write this novel, you had to imagine what it was like to go on a sex tour, to pay over $100,000 to go on a sex tour with the promise that you would meet, you know, the kind of beautiful woman who would never really be seen with you in real life. Like, that's why the men go on this. And so you had to imagine what it was like what the best and worst parts of paying a woman for sex might be. And can you talk a little bit about what you came up with?
Well, of course, the best thing is that you can't be disappointed. The best thing is that you're not going to be looking at somebody and wishing that they would be with you and having them walk away from you. The worst thing is everything else. The worst thing is that a part of you has to know that you're with somebody who dislikes you. And I don't care what guys tell themselves, because there's all this mythology about the hooker who falls in love with you, the hooker who says, oh, I couldn't possibly take money, this was so wonderful. It's just not possible. You're with somebody who is enduring you. And you can build a wall between yourself and that truth, and you can anesthetize yourself to that reality. But some of it is going to slip through, and it's going to accumulate. And I think it is a guaranteed path to increased unhappiness in the end.
There's one other thing that your character Avery likes about being with a pro, and I just want to read this. He says, her responses were exactly as I've always fantasized but have never really experienced. In every other instance in which I have dived or rolled onto a bed and attempted to pull a woman in with me, I've always sensed some little hitch of hesitation, coming either from her desire not to be dominated or from some concern about personal safety, no matter how carefully I wrap the whole thing in playfulness. And then he compares, you know, having sex with a pro to dancing with a great dancer, you know, who knows how the moves should be. I thought that was very funny.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
This novel is also about a certain kind of masculinity, which the main character says he'd never really experienced before, like getting into fights with men and having to defend yourself. Can you talk about what you wanted to get at with the kind of masculinity represented on this tour?
Well, of course, the first thing that Avery feels is the horror of being in relatively close confines with a bunch of men. And it's something he's never liked. And it certainly comes from the chaos of his childhood, in which he Avery Jankowski is his name. It's his fourth name because his mother was a serial remarrier. And so the idea of men and their power over him and the threat that they represent has always made Avery just a little bit nervous. I don't think that he has ever totally been comfortable with himself as a masculine man. It could be why he's with a woman significantly younger than he doesn't know what the contours of his masculinity are. On this trip, it's one of the things he's starting to understand about himself, and he's finding a much fiercer Avery than he ever imagined. And he gets into fights. He saves himself from being drowned by somebody by basically ripping the flesh off of his leg. He stands up to the most abusive and nasty member of the trip that he's on. And he actually becomes such a menace on this trip that the tour leader has to take steps against him.
There's one guy on the tour is complaining about women who like artsy type men. And he says, listen up, honey, Mr. Artsy Pants wouldn't even be able to make his morning espresso if people like my friends weren't out there busting our asses, getting the oil drilled, the cold mined, the tin, the copper. It's called the real world. It's called reality. So do me a favor and do not even mention art and singing and dancing and making little pictures, because where I come from, that's strictly child's play. As a writer yourself, do you know men who you figure look at you that way as Mr. Artsy Pants, like who don't understand what the real world is like, what real men do?
I usually get this. They say, what have you written? Anything I might have read? And I usually say, well, tell me everything you've read. I'll let you know if one of mine's on that list. And then they say, well, probably my wife would know your stuff. You know, they you know, there are very proud. Some men are very proud of not having enough time, not having enough energy after a long week of pulling riches out of the earth, whatever they imagine that they're doing, to devote themselves to reading a novel or going to a ballet or a concert, except, you know, if they owe their wife this favor.
The journalist in this book who goes on the sex tour with the intention of writing about it is the kind of journalist who does a lot of pieces where he puts himself into unusual predicaments and then writes about it, you know, or he gets an unusual job like working at a puppy mill so he can write about what life is like at the puppy mill. And he also writes a very autobiographical piece that really reveals a lot about his mother, and she feels quite betrayed that he would write about such private things in her life. You're a journalist in addition to being a novelist. In your journalism, I think you've mostly written about music. And I wonder what you think about Avery's form of journalism.
Well, I didn't have a problem with it. It's not the kind of journalism that I do, and it's not the kind of journalism that I would ever do, because if I have something personal and really core to write about, I would write about it in a novel, and I wouldn't, you know, frankly, waste it in a magazine piece. And for me, doing journalism is a way to get out of myself, not to get further into myself, so I like to write about other people and go someplace new and see something that I hadn't seen before and talk to somebody great. But I don't really have any particular attitude toward what Avery does. I mean, it's not what I would do, but I believe that he would do it. And I certainly have read journalism like that, and I don't sit there reading it with, you know, clucking my tongue and shaking my head sadly. It's just, it's not what I would do, but it's what he would do. It's what, frankly, I think he is able to do. I mean, he's not probably as wonderful a writer as he would like to be.
In your novel, the main character has devoted a lot of his life to trying to recover from his childhood. And, you know, he's not on the greatest terms with his mother, doesn't seem to really respect her very much. But without giving much away, I'll say that he has reason to rethink some of his thoughts about her through the course of the novel. And I guess I'm wondering if your parents are still alive and if your feelings about your childhood or them have changed as you've gotten older and understood more about their lives and about adulthood and the perils of life and all of that.
My mother's still alive, and in fact, this book is dedicated to my mother. One of the many things that happened to me in the course of writing this novel is that I lost my father, and that was really, really difficult. I'm an only child, so like many only children, I'm quite close to my parents. And losing my father was devastating. I don't really share Avery's childhood. I feel like I've written in and around my childhood enough that I've gone on to other people's childhoods at this point. The idea of having a mother who was taking her identity from whatever man was in her life is about as far from the mother who I have and the mother who I had as a child as you can get, because my mother was a premature feminist and was really a trailblazer in that respect. And I was always raised with the idea that women were psychologically and economically independent, which was not the case with Avery's mother.
You know, you mentioned that your father died while you were writing the book. In your acknowledgments, you say, while I was in the process of writing this book, four people died, all of whom have been integral to my life's joy and without whom my life has become less comprehensible. And I was very moved by your description of life having become less comprehensible without them, because Well, I think it's a perfect way of putting it. I think the people we're close to, there are memory banks. They're the people who explain our lives to us. I really don't know what my question is. I just thought that you'd found the right way of putting it.
Yes, we all go through it. It's really, really the grimmest part of life is saying goodbye to the people who mean so much to you.
As you get older, I mean, as we get older, we lose more people because the people we know get older too.
I'm trying to make a bunch of young friends now. Really young.
I guess if you don't mind my asking, what have you been going through and feeling closer to mortality by having lost people who are close to you and, you know, knowing that you're getting older yourself, losing a father, which always raises the question of mortality?
I never doubted my own mortality, but of course this does bring it closer, and this man who is standing between it and me is no longer there, so now it's just it and me. I don't know that it's changing my life as a writer, because I always felt that I was anxious to get on with it, and I still am. And I know it's going to come to an end, and I think that I've come to some sort of terms with it, because there's no other way. There's only one path, and that's the path. And I never believed that I was going to be an exception to that. I never believed that there was anything that you could do about it at all. And I just feel, I think what I feel is a little less patient with wasting time and with doing things that are dull and with repeating things just because you've done them before and they're easy to do. But frankly, Terry, I've always had that part of me. I've never wanted to be bored, and I never wanted my life to be flat. And I always wanted to live so I could feel I did everything I could while I was still here, because, you know, obviously we're not going to be here forever.
Well, Scott Spencer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's great to talk to you, Terry.
Scott Spencer's new novel is called Willing. We're going to listen back to an interview with the British film director Anthony Minghella. He died yesterday at the age of 54 from complications following surgery for tonsil cancer. Minghella won an Academy Award for directing the film The English Patient. His other movies include Truly Madly Deeply, Cold Mountain, Breaking and Entering, and The Talented Mr. Ripley. When I spoke with him in 1999, we talked first about writing and directing The Talented Mr. Ripley. It's based on the Patricia Highsmith novel of the same name and received an Oscar nomination for Best Screenplay. It begins when a wealthy industrialist wants to convince his son to return home from the bohemian life he's living in Italy. The father mistakenly believes that a young man named Tom Ripley is his son's old chum from Princeton, and offers to send Ripley to Italy to talk his son into coming home. Ripley, who is broke, wants that free trip, so he doesn't admit he's not the son's friend. In this scene, Ripley, played by Matt Damon, has just arrived in Italy. Making it look like a chance encounter, he goes up to the wealthy son Dickie, played by Jude Law, and Dickie's girlfriend, played by Gwyneth Paltrow.
Dickie Greenleaf?
Who's that?
It's Tom. Tom Ripley.
Tom Ripley?
We were at Princeton together.
Okay. Did we know each other?
Hello. Well, I knew you, so I suppose you must have known me.
Princeton's like a fog. America's like a fog. This is Marge Sherwood. Tom, sorry, what is it?
Ripley.
How do you do?
How do you do, Marge?
Once Tom Ripley gets a taste of Dickie's life, his money, his freedom, his charisma, he wants it for himself and goes to extremes to get it. Dickie is a jazz fan, an amateur saxophonist. In a scene set in a jazz club, Dickie sits in on saxophone and invites Ripley to sing. Before we hear my conversation with Anthony Minghella, here's that scene with Matt Damon as Ripley singing.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable. Yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak when you open it?
When the Matt Damon character of Tom Ripley prepares to meet Dickie, the wealthy young American who's living in Italy, he studies up on some of the things that Dickie knows so he could kind of impress him and be on the same wavelength. So he studies up on jazz because Dickie is an amateur jazz saxophonist. And so he gives himself his own like blindfold test. He plays records and tries to guess like who's playing on it. How did you choose which performances you wanted to use? Were there certain like iconic figures of the time or records that were special to you that you wanted to get in? I mean, for example, there's a scene where he sings a la Chet Baker, My Funny Valentine. Why that particular performance? Why make that the centerpiece?
Well, I thought particularly about Chet Baker. First of all, there's something so intimate and secretive about that song and the performance of that version of the song.
Yeah, well put.
And I think it was an opportunity for Matt to sing to Jude or Ripley to sing to Dickie in a way that I think really illuminates the whole business of the popular song. Because if you look at any dance floor when a ballad is playing and you see lovers crooning into each other's ears and they're saying things in song that they would never have the nerve to say without the cloak of music around them. It's very hard, for a man to say to a woman, your lips are laughable and photographable, but you're my favorite work of art. But you can say that if it's sung to a simple melody. And I think the whole allure of a popular song is it enables us to speak from our heart, but with the ballast of music. And so that seemed to be, a very good choice of song for Ripley. I always felt that Chet Baker acted his songs rather than sang them. And so I felt confident that Matt could act as Ripley that song to Dickie.
Tom Ripley, the character, says it's better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody. Frank Rich, writing in the New York Times Magazine section, said, in this age of rampant reinvention, when political candidates, entrepreneurs, and criminals change selves like quicksilver, the talented Mr. Ripley may be Hollywood's most chilling and up-to-date portrait of our national character. What do you personally relate to about the character of Tom Ripley? Because there must be some personal connection there.
Oh, I think I felt huge connection to Ripley when I reread the novel when I came to adapt it. I think essentially it's this feeling of being on the outside of things, of being strange in some way, of feeling too that you have to be secret about what makes you particular. That I suppose it goes back to the sense of being in a schoolyard when teams are being selected and the fear of not being chosen, the fear of not being admitted really to a life that you aspire to. And particularly in Britain where I was brought up, where I think the issues of class are tattooed on your forehead. You walk around with second rate and second class imprinted on your forehead. Then I think that I'm very, very alert to the striations of class and to the sense that there's a better life being lived, that your nose is pressed up against the window of a life. And my family is Italian, and I was growing up on a small island off the coast of Britain. So I felt there were so many membranes between me and what seemed to be the center of things. And that, I don't want to make any special claim for that, because I think all of us have within us some reference to what it feels like to be on the outside. And those were my particular things. I mean, I was perfectly happy growing up. It's just that I always felt in some way that I didn't entirely belong. And I think that feeling of not belonging is particularly exacerbated in, you know, late adolescence, early adulthood, which is really where this story is situated. It's very much a story of young people trying to reinvent themselves in the country of Italy, in Europe, which I think was had particular attraction to Americans over the course of this century.
Now, you said that part of the reason why you kind of have this sense of empathy for Tom Ripley is that you felt a bit of an outsider growing up in an Italian family that had emigrated to Britain and lived in the Isle of Wight. Now, what part your family, which part of your family came first there? Was it your grandparents, your parents?
Well, it's a very convoluted story, but essentially my mother had fetched up in the Isle of Wight just after the war, but basically on the advice of a priest. Her family had settled from a small village in Italy near Monte Cassino, and her father had disappeared off to Ireland, I think to lead a completely new life, and had abandoned my grandmother and her three daughters. And so with the wisdom and the navigation of the local parish priest in Scotland, where they, for some reason, were living, they were redirected down to the Isle of Wight, a place they'd never heard of, and probably they just wanted to get rid of them. And so it was as far south as you can go in the British Isles. So they went down to the island. And my father, meanwhile, was living in a village very close to Valvery, where my mother came from, and was brought over, as many young men were brought either to America or to Britain, where the wealthy families would pay their train ticket or airfare, and in a way to provide cheap labor. And he was taken in by an ice cream making firm in Portsmouth, which is a few miles from the island. And the people there said, well, you know, there's a girl who comes from a village next door to you in Italy across the way. And so they ended up courting each other on the Isle of Wight ferry there's a long pier in Ryde, and I think they would troll up and down the pier in the morning, then my father would go back to the work, and eventually he married and they settled on the island, and I was born a couple of years later.
I want to ask you something else about your family. I know your father ended up making ice cream, and I think that there was a brand called Minghella ice cream, is that right?
That's absolutely true, yeah.
So were you, I mean, would this have been like being the son of Ben and Jerry's or something, or the son of Seal Test when I was young? Or
I wish it had been the son of Ben and Jerry's.
Or?
I would never have got a job. I just would have retired by now. Funnily enough, I think one of the Ripley experiences I had when I was growing up was that on the island, which is essentially a very poor place, it's a wonderful place, but the 90% of the population live from hand to mouth. But it has this border of large, you know, of rich people, extremely privileged people who descend in the summer months. It's always been, since Queen Victoria's time, it's been a place where the wealthy and privileged have gone to spend their summers. There's a big, boating regatta there every year, Cowes, which is the home of sailing. And so it was very much the experience of my growing up that the island would become full. I wouldn't use the word infested, although that was the word that came to my mind. It was full of the young and privileged and gorgeous and wealthy every summer while we were toiling away. And my summers were always spent behind the glass of an ice cream van serving ice cream. And I certainly remember the feeling of not being inside the world I wanted to be in, but rather imprisoned in the cage of this ice cream van. And I remember once driving along, delivering some ice cream in my father's van, and being stopped by two young, very beautiful people who could very well have been Dickie Greenleaf and Marge Sherwood, who wanted me to give them a ride. And so they got into my van, and after a while I asked them where they were going, and they said, oh, we're not going anywhere. We just wanted to sort of feel what it was like to be picked up by a local and taken somewhere. And I never felt so humiliated and so clear about my own social standing. And I remember vowing then that I would escape from the prison of the ice cream van and try and reinvent myself. So I suppose that was my most defining Ripley moment.
When you were trying to reinvent yourself and when you were becoming, you know, a young writer and everything, did people meet you and go, oh, Minghella, is that like the ice cream family Minghella?
Well, unfortunately, I'd like to say that was true, but my father's ice cream was really only sold on the island and just in the sort of vicinity, and I'd run away far enough to the university not to be identified as the sort of purveyor of raspberry ripple. But I remember one thing that was, I mean, first of all, you talk a lot about you know, where the Ripley element in you comes from and this feeling of alienation as a child or whatever. But I had the best childhood, and my parents are incredibly close to me. In fact, they're in the movie. They were in The English Patient as well. And
Who are they in the movie? Who are they in Ripley?
You see my father playing bocce in the square with Jude Law. They're standing next to each other. My mother's sitting in a seat beside them, and they're just in that scene because they came out to visit, and they were in The English Patient playing accordions and singing, and they're a very, very significant part of my life. And so I would hate it to sound like I was bewailing a childhood, which was in fact, you know, a wonderful one and a rich one. And I think that often the very things which make you feel strange as a child are the things which become incredibly precious to you as an adult. And the feeling of being a foreigner, and the feeling of, we had a cafe and there was never really any private life. Well, our private life was played out in, you know, the environment of a cafe kitchen. So every triumph and every failure was always paraded in front of the staff or in front of some customers. And that was, you know, sometimes quite soul-destroying as a child. But looking back on it, I think it was the most wonderful way of understanding myself and understanding the way the world worked. And so I feel now it's all privileged. But I remember that reading about Fellini, who's one of my, you know, cinema heroes, and his father was a seller of olive oil and sausage and salami and prosciutto, and he would talk about his father coming home from selling, carrying a big piece of prosciutto or a bottle of wine, and saying, "I make the best wine and the best this, and I can't sell it, and what's wrong with people?" And Fellini quietly vowing to himself he would never, ever sell anybody anything. And I had exactly the same experience when I used to drive around in my ice cream van playing The Happy Wanderer on the chimes and thinking, one day I'll escape from all of this. I'll never sell anybody anything. And just like Fellini, 20 years later, I find myself in Hollywood, you know, trying to sell my own brand of ice cream. So I think we all come back to ourselves in some way.
Was The Happy Wanderer like the theme of the truck or something?
Ding, 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 ding. It just to drive me out of my mind. In fact, I must say that when I was with Gabriel Yared and we were talking about the music for Ripley, and I was trying to think of some way of finding a noise that would be intensely nostalgic and disturbing for Ripley, we came up with something which is perilously like the tune on my ice cream van. I mean, it's just a music box sound. And I know it's partly because of that, and it's partly because my grandmother had a music box in her room, which was from Venice. It was just a gondola with a ballerina dancing on it, and it was the saddest, saddest tune. And I think somehow those two sounds, because when Gabriel and I are working on the score, we work together in his studio. And I'm sure that the provenance of both, you know, of that particular theme in the film, this very strange and music box-like theme, comes both from the ice cream van and the gondola in my grandmother's bedroom.
Wow, I'm still registering on me having to drive all day with the Happy Wanderer, Valdera, my knapsack on my back.
That's it.
Oh, geez.
Except that they were clockwork chimes, and so you would wind them up, and by the time you got to the end of your street, they'd begun to wind down, and so it's given me a particularly sensitive ear to pitch as I've become an adult.
Before I let you go, I have to ask you, did you ever see the Seinfeld episode? Everybody must ask you this, in which Elaine went to see The English Patient and didn't like it, but her boss, Peterman, loves it. And so rather than get into a fight with him, she tells him she didn't see it. So if he, of course, has to do everything in his power to get her to go because he's sure she's going to love it. Everyone must ask you if you've seen the episode. Did you see it?
Well, you know, I saw a piece of it when I was in Los Angeles. I haven't seen the whole episode. I was enormously flattered that they took the trouble even to... it was an index to me of how much The English Patient had pervaded the public consciousness, that anybody would be remotely amused by this. And in fact, in Britain, there was a much more sort of devastating and just devastatingly funny attack on The English Patient, which was called The Toy Patient, in which they dressed up some bears and, you know... woolen rabbits and played out the story with puppets, and it was much funnier and much better than my film. I mean, I just took it as a great compliment, really, that anybody cared enough.
I think
the other thing I would say is this, you know, is that I feel so uniconoclastic as a filmmaker, and it's always very strange to me that people can either be so passionately for or against what I'm doing, because I feel like the most equivocal person in the world. And when I made Truly Madly Deeply, I remember that that in 1 week, I remember reading a list of somebody's 10 favorite films of all time and getting that glow of pride in reading that somebody thought this was one of the 10 best movies ever made. And the next day on BBC television, they had a wonderful program where people could consign the things they most hated to Room 101, this program was called. And the very first thing on the next day that I saw was this guy saying, and the first thing I put in Room 101 is Truly, Madly, Deeply. So it just seems extraordinary to me that such an equivocal person and such an equivocal filmmaker should excite, you know, such extreme reactions in people.
Film director Anthony Minghella recorded in 1999. He died yesterday at the age of 54 from complications following surgery for tonsil cancer. He had just completed work on an adaptation of the novel The Number One Ladies Detective Agency, which is a pilot for a BBC and HBO series. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.